Hi, I'm Ryan Archibald, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. And let me tell you, we have got a great one for you today. Our guest today is Ryan Archibald, better known as Arch, as we like to say in the business. He is a director, teacher, and one of the best improvisers here in Chicago. He was in the touring company at Second City, as well as a resident stage in Las Vegas. He has played at the I.O. with such legendary Herald teams as 3033 and People of Earth, as well as the Improv All-Stars and the Boys at Second City. Ryan also performed with Boom Chicago in Amsterdam. We talked to Ryan about the three things that he likes to start an improv scene with so it helps him get into character immediately. Also, he helped me how to get over bitterness and letting go of the goal to enjoy the journey. Before we get to the episode, I just want to say that it's a big week here at Improv Nerd at our headquarters here in Evanston, Illinois, a suburb outside of Chicago. We are preparing for our five-year anniversary show at the Chicago Improv Festival, which will be in this huge theater called the Athenaeum, between 8,000 and 1,000 people. So that's the biggest crowd I've ever played, I believe, for Improv Nerd or just in general. And we're on the bill. There's three other podcasts, and the headliner is Kevin McDonald. As you remember him from Kids in the Hall. He's going to be doing like a variety show, and he's bringing in all the big guests. He's bringing in Bob Saget and Kevin Allison, who was our guest last week, who was on the state and does this wonderful podcast called Risk. And we will be doing our podcast, Improv Nerd, and our guest will be Scott Atzett. And Scott is, I've known Scott since we both went to Columbia College here in Chicago in the 80s. And it was very interesting because there was this legendary teacher, Martin DeMott, and Martin was a great, great improv teacher. And I was a jerk. I mean, I was probably not a very easy student to have in improv classes. One is, like, I always like to play, like, the smart, sarcastic guy, you know? So I never wanted to do characters or voices or change my physicality. So that had to be hard to deal with. But the other thing is, even back then, what am I, 18, 19, maybe 20 tops, I am obsessed with fame. Like, the whole idea of doing improv to get famous, that was in me even when I was young. And Scott, on the other hand, he didn't even care about that. He just wanted to get better. And I'll tell you something, this guy was really, really good. I mean, I was jealous of him, you know, because he was so... Every scene he did seemed to work, you know? And the other thing about Scott was he approached it from an actor's point of view. I was like, I got to get the laughs. I'm going to be the smart, sarcastic guy, you know? And he was like an actor. And he's a great actor. And he's just an amazing improviser. And he's so much fun to work with. So I'm really looking forward to working with him on the fifth-year anniversary show. So we'll let you know how that goes. And I'm already in my head starting the old comparison of like, oh, my podcast isn't as big as Kevin McDonald's, and they're bringing in some big people like, and it's on this network, Feral Audio. My Favorite Murder is going to be there, which is like the number one comedy podcast on iTunes. So it's going to be very hard for me to not compare myself, and I love to compare myself to other people, not to make myself feel better, usually to make myself feel worse. Enough about me. You're going to love this episode of Ryan Archibald, and the thing that focus on here when we get to improvising, he has this great system of the three things he likes to do before he goes into an improv scene that gives him a very strong point of view, gives him a character, and we tried it out and see if it worked. So it's a live episode, so you get to hear improv. We get to dissect it. We get to take questions from the audience. So I feel like we're back home. So here it is. Enjoy it, the Ryan Archibald episode.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
improvised it on Hinge. Do you remember years ago?
Yeah, I loved on Hinge.
Did you? What did you love about that show?
Because we were acting. That's what I loved about that show. That show was about like behavior and making connections and like. And every once in a while, I think one of the renditions we did, it would get really dreamy and pull in and out of like reality and fantasy. So there was some cool stuff.
You gave me a note on that show that was so helpful. I don't know if you remember this. I came in my typical neurotic, insecure self, and I'm like, oh, I don't feel funny. I don't feel good. I don't want to improvise tonight. And you know what you said to me? Do you remember this? No.
I don't know.
You said, make sure you get out there first. And I did. I remember doing a scene with Joe Canale.
Yeah.
And it went really well, and I have to thank you for that.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Good job, me, back then.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So you grew up in Barrington, Illinois.
I did.
Okay, and you did sports in high school.
That's
you did
right.
a lot of musical theater, uh-huh. swing choir, uh-huh. all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Usually jocks and musical theater people, they don't mix, right?
That's right. We had a theater teacher and a choir teacher that really went out and kind of recruited. How'd they recruit you? Yeah, just like, hey, we're going to do, I remember like my sophomore year, they're like, hey, we're going to do West Side Story. We need a bunch of big athletic guys for it. And we all went and auditioned for it, and we played the Sharks, because the Sharks just had to show up and dance. And then like all the like talented dudes they put over as the Jets, because they had to like sing and dance, right? So, but I kind of got bit by the bug and loved performing and like took a bunch of acting classes.
What did you like about it?
Oh man, I really like pretending and having people watch me pretend. So, you know, like it's that simple. I love to be other people, and I really love to be in a room that's paying attention and feeling that energy. I love to entertain.
Did you also told me that you were a fan of comedy young.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you got into comedy?
Yeah. I remember like sneaking away with like Eddie Murphy, Delirious, and Richard Pryor tapes.
How old were you then?
Probably like 7 or 8 maybe. We'd get them from my friend's older brother.
Which was like getting like which was scoring like liquor or cigarettes.
Yeah,
I mean, because that was Delirious was like
pretty raunchy.
Yeah.
And we didn't even know what some of the jokes were. We just thought it was hilarious the way he delivered him and the cadence and the, you know, the attitude. So really early on, and found SNL really early on. It was a big part of my childhood of like, you know, hanging out with my buddies on Saturday night and watching the show. And in high school, that turned into piling into one of our cars and going out to like Second City Northwest on a Friday night,
which
or
was
Saturday night.
So. Second City Northwest, they don't have it anymore, but it was not far from Barrington. It was in Rolling Meadows.
Yeah, it was about 10 miles away. And so not that far. In suburban, that'd be like 30 minutes of driving, 10
right,
miles.
Right, right. All on the highway.
But yeah, it was really close. And one of the perks of like hanging out with theater. Hanging out and like and doing choir and stuff too I had like a really cool girlfriend, and she loved comedy too, so we ended up going to a bunch of shows and had friends that wanted to see shows, and we were really aware that like what a unique thing it was, like Chris Farley was just on that stage a few years ago, and like we thought it was really cool, you know. I mean, it was like instant. Like, I remember just, like, standing in the hallway and, like, looking at Utterbox for hours.
Now, Utterbox is an artist who draws, like, when you do a main stage show, they would draw, like, a caricature of the cast.
Yeah.
And that was, like, a huge honor.
Yeah, and now they've got him up all over the building. But as a kid, just being, like, you know, recognizing people from a sketch who you'd seen on TV, even, like, in a Wendy's commercial or something, and just being, like, oh, that person's in that. Like, we just were so, like, total nerds about it, you know?
That something, like, okay, that you want, that became a goal of yours?
You know, I don't think I ever thought about it as a job until, like, late in college. It didn't dawn on me that someone like me could go and, like, take classes. And I thought you had to have, like, a major theater background. I guess it just didn't click. But then, in college, we found out about classes at I.O., and then, of course, we found out about classes here. But, that was a goal of, like, by the time I was a junior in high school, in college, to, like, I'm going to move to I.O. and take classes there.
And it was interesting, when you started, you said you were thinking about either being a writer or a teacher.
Yeah. And I just get to do both those things now. Yeah, right. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I think my ambitions after college were, I was really obsessed with short story. And I thought maybe I would want to write some fiction, or I don't know, and would pursue creative writing. And I thought maybe going to I.O. and to Second City and Annoyance for a couple years and hanging out would give me a good thing to for like a writer to do, you know. And then I just got bit by performing and realized, like, no, I like the performing aspect of it. I like the instant response, the connection with the audience.
And you also said that you were started at I.O. in the late 90s, and you really liked the vibe.
Totally.
It was different than what was going on at Second City.
Yeah, absolutely. Second City just seems so grown up, right? And
the performers did?
Yeah, the performers and just like the whole like night staff, and you know, they just seemed a little older, you know, and a little more standoffish, and it seemed like more of a I don't know, professional thing. Just like just you could feel the distance. As like at 19 and 20 and 21, you could feel the distance. But at I.O., you could go and see a show, and then people, you know, dressed like you, and it'd be someone who's 19 performing with someone who's in, you know, in their late 40s or early 50s, and that, I just thought that was so cool, you know, and it just, everyone looked different, and it wasn't so cookie cutter, and I think just it being in a dirty little cabaret and right in the middle of Wrigley Field, you know, Wrigleyville, and being so familiar with that neighborhood my whole life, you know, it just felt like a good place to be, right? And it felt really, really comfortable. Plus, like, the nights, the bartenders were very accessible, and then they'd go up on stage and perform, and they'd come back and pour you a drink, and, you know, you were at I.O. in that time, you know how, like, it just wasn't huge. Like, I.O. is huge now. Back then, there was, like, you'd see the same maybe 30, 40, 50 people around. How you now see the same, like, 300, 400, 500 people hanging around there on a weekly basis. So it just was, like, a smaller club, I guess. I don't know.
And, you know, speak to the smallness, because I know when I was there, that was in the I started in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And you started in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And you, at level one, were put on a Herald team.
That's right. My level one class, by when we started level two, we also were on the Herald schedule, and that was People of Earth.
This was a great team.
We grew it into a pretty great team.
Yeah. Was it? How did it start out?
We were really lucky. We were thrown on that team with Peter Gwynn as our coach, who remained our coach for 5 years. And in 5 years, he missed rehearsal maybe 12 times, which is like unreal, because like, he was touring and doing everything else too. So like we had just a very committed coach. So we had a class together, and then we had Annoyance class together, and then we had a rehearsal together, and every once in a while we'd have a show, and that was like our whole first year together. So we were doing two classes and a rehearsal every week together. So by the time our second year came around, we were just doing cool things with the Herald.
And how many people were in that group originally?
There is 8 originally, and then Stan Sipp left. And then later on, we added Laurel Kopic.
And then how did you all agree to go, okay, we're taking classes at I.O., let's bump it up. Let's all take the same class at Annoyance.
Well, we were just that nerdy. I mean, we were just so into it. So Danny and Bill and Jason.
Danny Mora, Bill Arnett.
And Jason Pardo. They all came up from
Florida
together. Yep, so they're Theater Strike Force. And again, St. Clair and from Missouri and Alex Fenders came from Maryland and had been in Chicago for a while. And we all just kind of randomly ended up in the same class. And then Dave Hill and I are both from Barrington. We didn't know each other growing up, but we happened to grow up like 5 miles away from each other. We all ended up in the same class together, and we were all like chomping at the bit. And Sharna, being the businesswoman she is, was like, oh, they love it. I don't even have to sell this shit to them. They love it already. So she just put us on a team, and we just kept like loving it. You know, UCB had a TV show at the time, and it just seemed like people were figuring out what I.O. was too. It wasn't just such an underground thing. It was kind of,
well, because the space,
I.O. West happened at the same time.
Right, and the space was fairly new in 98, right?
Yeah, 98, yep. Yeah, it was just 2 years old. So, I just felt like, looking back, I know I hit it right at the right time. Because if I had kicked around in the system for a couple years before finding some people that I loved, I probably wouldn't have made it, you know.
When you look back at that and say like, oh, this was just synchronicity, how do you put that in perspective?
Oh, I just am thankful for it, you know, honestly. Yeah. Wow, I'm getting a little choked up. I'm just really thankful. I mean, half of that group ended up being like my closest friends for my entire adult life, and then that group transformed into 3033. So artistically, like, this group of people have been the most satisfying thing that I've been a part of, and it's just been a consistent thing. So 5 years with People of Earth, and then another 9 years with 3033, that's, you know, 14, 15 years performing regularly with the same, like, core of people. You know, that is, like, my favorite thing about improv. If any, you know, if I had to walk away and someday daydream about the glory days, it's like, yeah, I had 15 years of glory days working with people that are hilarious and amazing and just so lucky. And so, yeah, so I think back and just think, thankful we all just kind of ended up in the same class at the same time, and that Sharna has a good enough business model to capitalize on opportunity, you know.
And you said something too that I thought was interesting, is when you started in People of Earth, you were like, okay, we're going to go farther, we're going to be all success together.
Yeah, I mean, we were young, and we really thought that's how comedy worked, or at least we thought that's how comedy was going to work. That this was this thing where comedians would come up as a group. So, you know, we thought that if it happened to UCB, it could happen to another group if, you know, we were in the right place at the right time and we worked hard together and we developed comedy. Now, I think along the way, other opportunities, you know, pulled us away, or we just kind of realized, oh man, 8 white dudes just isn't going to be interesting to anyone right now. And that was 15 years ago, right? But yeah, that really drove us to be good, to get better, was the thought that, like, oh, we're gonna like move up together, like we're gonna be this six, like we could be a success story together, you know.
And what when you say success story, what were you guys gonna achieve?
I think probably just we were all thinking of TV, like we wanted to get on TV together, you know. I think that's what we were. I think that's, you know. I'm sure we talked about it. I can't even think back if there was a specific goal of what we wanted, but I know we had it in our minds of like, oh, we would, you know, we would master the Herald, and then we'd come up with a couple other forms, and then we'd do a sketch show, and then we'd do a pilot, we'd film a pilot, and we just never got to the round to feeling satisfied with our sketch comedy work.
You did try writing sketches, right?
Yeah, we did a sketch comedy show. It was okay. Yeah. I mean, if I had the opportunity to sit down with the 6 of them now and write a sketch comedy show, that would be a real delightful thing to do. I just don't think we were mature enough or focused enough to like write a real sketch comedy show. I think thinking back, we were trying to always imitate other styles too much, you know.
You know, when you think about it, and it brings me back to, There is a part, especially when we started out in the 80s and in the 90s, mm-hmm. It's almost like a coming of age when you realize, you know what? We're not all going to, we're all not going to all hit it together at the same time.
Hell yeah, for
sure. Do you remember that that was a realization for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that realization of watching people in our group, not, you know, maybe outside of People of Earth too, just in this generation. Some people just accelerating through the system and having opportunity, and then other people not having opportunity. And then just looking at the wide range of, like, sometimes the most talented person that deserves it just shoots up to the top. Sometimes the most unbearable asshole just, like, shoots up to the top. Like,
that's the one I'm trying to figure
yeah.
out, you know?
It just happens. And then you'll turn around and 3 people get picked up and you'll be like, oh man, I didn't think that they were like in any place to get picked up like that, right?
That's picked what up really, for like Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, or... I mean Chicago really had a major shift when they, you know, whenever the showcases started happening, and it really equalized the community, right? It didn't, you didn't have to be at a certain like tier of performance or opportunity to get that look.
Because really, you know, it was you were on main stage or ETC, yeah. And that's where they would scout.
Yeah, or maybe they come down and see something at Annoyance, you know. But yeah, seeing a 24 people twice a year was unheard of, you know. And going through that process a couple times myself is, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing.
Did you audition for a showcase stuff?
Yeah, I've auditioned. I've sent material in through like Vegas, and then
when you were at Second City at Vegas.
Yeah, that show got me some attention, and then same thing with Boom, because Boom has a connection. We all sent in material 1 year, and then yeah, I've done Sharna's showcase like I think 2 or 3 times. Yeah.
Anything come of it?
A little feedback here and there. The most interest I ever got was back in 2007, where I had a series of phone calls with them and was like signing non-disclosure forms and sending them content and stuff, and it was like felt like it was like the process of something was happening. I was dealing with actual people from SNL, you know, casting people, and it was kind of exciting. The other times have just been like requests through, you know, Boom or through Second City or through.
You did Boom Chicago originally mm-hmm. for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got hired here at Second City for the touring company.
Yep.
Then you do 2 reviews in Las Vegas.
Yep.
And then for the last 8 years, you've done Boats. You've directed for Second City. Mm-hmm. You teach at I.O.
Mm-hmm.
But you never got main stage or ETC.
That's right. Yeah, never have. For 5 years, I put in a grind, going for it. Did, you know, ships and city shows and a handful of shows in Up. And, you know, I think I was in the realm of consideration for a long time for a couple of different reviews. But, yeah, it certainly is happens to so many people who go through the system here that there's only so many jobs and so many opportunities, and not everyone gets the opportunity to work that job. And you know, I know it's going to piss me off 10 years from now. It's just something that I'm goal oriented. But also something that was like in my life since I was a kid, I feel like that. So probably got way too distracted for a while too. I've probably spent maybe a year or two too long chasing the same thing. And then I ended up found myself directing, which, again, I feel like, still working with the exact same people doing a very similar thing. And you know, I love the company, and it's fun, but it's also still on a path of like, what else is going to happen with this thing? So I think last couple of years I've just come to terms with working here at Second City and not being so goal oriented. I think that kept me from enjoying the path for a long time, I think. So just trying to be a little more zen and present and happy to, you know.
How did being goal-oriented, because goals have never worked for me, but how has being goal-oriented got in the way of having fun and having joy with this?
I think because it keeps you focused on that there's something else that you want to achieve. So instead of just being like, oh shit, I'm poolside in Phoenix. I've got a show in 4 hours that I love to do with people that I love to do it, instead of like sulking in that moment, just enjoying that moment. I really think it's that. Just like, what else can I do? I'm on the road now. I don't want to be on the road. I want to be in a job that puts me in the theater 8 times a week. And I know what would happen when I would get that would be, okay, now I'm on stage here. When am I going to do this thing? And I think that's just chased me for a good 10 years of my career.
And then you also said, you know, I'm something I'll probably be angry with. It was a dream of mine, too, to be at Second City.
Yeah.
Me, I totally self-sabotaged.
Sure.
Every opportunity. How have you been able to deal with that anger? And how do you express that anger without being bitter? That's something I struggle with.
I struggle with it. Yeah, I think it gets in. It boils over at times. Really, when I don't expect it to. Yeah, it's a frustrating thing. You know, I think. How do I put it? I don't think I do a very good job, and at times don't even attempt to hide like bitterness or being like having a chip on my shoulder.
When would I, like, you know? We're not seeing it in this interview. When would I see your bitterness? At the bar, after a show, at home?
Oh, probably casually while we're working together.
So, you like know? A passive aggressive comment?
Yeah, passive aggressive sarcasm. I'm very, you know.
What about gossip? Like,
I'm not much of a gossiper, but yeah.
I love gossip. Yeah, yeah.
Probably maybe at the bar. I think the people closest to me probably see my bitterness the most. You know?
Now, here's something I have to ask you too. Yeah. When you see somebody like advance, right?
Sure.
Maybe they get main stage. Maybe they get on Saturday Night Live. Do you go, "Oh, I could do that"? You know, why did they get that? Or do you turn it on yourself and say, "Fuck, what am I doing wrong"?
Yeah, I was more of "Fuck, what am I doing wrong"? Yeah. Every once in a while, there'd be someone who'd get something that you're just like, "No, not that person."
Why? Because of talent or because you didn't like them?
Yeah, I get bitter when I see someone I think is a piece of shit get a good job, you know? It's like, no, that sucks. There's something about me that wants people to be good, like good-hearted, or at least
I'm
like
the same way.
Yeah. And like, I know that's possible, and I'm not even sure I'm totally good-hearted all the time. So, whatever, but I these days I just get excited when people I know make it. So, you know, I spent too much of my time being like feeling competitive. Now it's like, you got main stage, kick ass, that's amazing. You got a great job, I love it.
And how much of that do you really mean?
Almost all of it. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy for people having success in this, because now the reality is, if people stop having success in this, then all this goes away. Like, my whole job now is to help people like through the system. So if people stop getting it, then there's going to be no system to like shuffle people through, right? I mean, this is a $10 million room we're sitting in.
The training center.
This whole training center is gorgeous.
Yeah.
But it is something that feeds something that's larger.
Did you ever think you would see something like this when you started? This is state of the art. This training center. $10 million.
It's amazing.
Did you ever think you'd see something like that?
No. Well, I remember seeing it for the first time and just being like, "Oh my God! I just can't believe they built this. It's beautiful, and these are great rooms to teach in, and these are great rooms to perform in. Like they did a wonderful job, and there's something to be said that with the way we come that this building is also a museum. It's not just a school; it's a museum. We're constantly celebrating other people's success, right? You know, I mean, the people that we put on the walls aren't the people that were the best on our stages. They're just the most famous people, right? I mean, if we just put a wall up of photos of people who were just the greatest second citizens, there's going to be a whole handful of people, you know, dozens of people we're not even going to recognize their faces, right? But that's what drives people to the building. And that's part of the business model. And, you know, IO has this great tangible package of Herald. Second City has less of a package other than, like, this could happen to you. It could. Come on. Don't you want it to happen to you? It could. I know people who it happened to. It almost happened to me. Come on. Let's go do this, right? So it's less, they need the bricks and mortar to show off the tangible product of what they're selling here, right?
You know, you also, for the last couple of years, have been a director. You've directed improv before that.
Mm-hmm.
What is your philosophy in directing? Because I think directing improv is one, and coaching is one of the most unappreciated jobs in improv.
Cool, yeah. I absolutely love directing comedy and sketch and improvisation. I feel like it's a good mix of like teaching and coaching and then just improvising. You know, so much of directing comedy is just being a good improviser and a good communicator, and running a room, keeping a room motivated and moving. I always approach each project and each group differently. I try to have a unique relationship and an organic relationship with the project and the cast and whatever I'm working on. And I think that keeps me from feeling stiff or stagnant, right? Just to really serve the people I'm working for. You know, I think that's one of the biggest things about me as a director is and as me as an improviser, I value other people's creativity more than my own. I want to help connect and build and make other people's brilliance happen. So, you know, when I approach, you know, my touring company, I'm there to train them and to showcase them and to put them in a flow of a show where they could shine. And I don't really care what the show, like the content of the show or like what we're saying. Like, I know we will say something. And I know that the show will have a strong point of view because I've cast people with really strong points of view. But then my job is to just serve them and to make sure that that point of view is protected and interesting. And at the end of the day, the show is funny too, you know.
So we're going to improvise now. Cool. And if I was in your class, what's one thing that you would try to teach me that you find important in improv?
I think valuing physical information.
Okay.
So intentionally giving and receiving nonverbal information.
Okay, so give me an example of that.
Cool. I think if you combine, so not physical information, that's emotion, which you depict physically, but that's concrete. So everyone knows when you're playing sad that you're sad, and everyone in the audience can relate. So emotion is tremendously important to physical information. Posture, changing your posture, leading with a different body part, you know, having a certain type of pant on for a character, that's so important to, you know, to you and giving your audience an opportunity to see you as someone different too. So that's subjective. And then we have action. Action activates environment. Action draws the audience in and requires them to participate in the creation, because if they're not trying to, you know, figure out what you're depicting with your motion, then they're completely pushed away from the piece. But if you are in action and it gives your audience an opportunity to start watching the piece from their mind's eye, then we're doing what we're trying to do, which is to unify the room in very simple ways and to get everyone to participate in the creation, to see as much of this scene from their mind's eye as you can. So if you combined emotion and posture, or emotion and action, or all three, that's a tremendously powerful way to begin a scene or to reset a scene with very little brain power. You know, I'm sad and I'm putting away library books. That looks really interesting to an audience. And it gives off a tremendous amount of potential information to my scene partner and to myself.
So we're in chairs, so that's going to limit us.
Sure.
I understand the emotion. That's pretty simple, right? Start with an emotion, a strong emotion.
Yep.
And then I understand what was the second thing you said?
Posture.
Posture that, you know, if you're sad, maybe you're more, you know, slumped down, right? And the action is that the taking of the putting the books away? Is that, would you say?
Well, action does a couple different things. Action gives you a location, and at least in your mind, because if you're touching something and you're seeing it, you're seeing where it comes from. But what it does is it's open for interpretation. So if I'm giving off a clear emotion, and then I'm also putting away what I think is books, you can name these things anything.
Right.
But in a few moves, I'm sad putting away books, and you calling out what I'm doing. Now we have context for our scene.
Right. You know. To me, when you were pantomiming this, it looked like you were playing solitaire.
Awesome. Great. So then now with my move and with you defining it as solitaire, I'm a sad guy playing solitaire. That's super fun. I can get my head around that. Mm-hmm. I've been a sad guy playing solitaire, right?
Haven't we all?
Yeah, for sure. If you owned a PC in the 90s, definitely.
Nice. Yeah.
If you come and watch me improvise, 90% of the time I'm going to initiate a scene physically. I'm going to change my posture. I'm going to interact with my environment, and I'm going to give you an emotion. Because I know that later on a piece, my words will be more important. And I want to build this relationship with an audience for them to watch me before they listen to me. So they're taking in all that information.
So you're not worried about, got to come up with something funny, got to have a strong initiation. Mm-hmm. You're almost embodying what a strong initiation is physically, emotionally, and with action or object work.
Trying to.
Okay.
Yeah. And the mindset behind this ultimately is to create a context for your scene first, then play the scene. So if we are focused on how we feel and who we are and what we're doing, that's enough context of a scene that we can just go anywhere. Instead of trying to build a scene the entire time, right? So that one of those scenes that the last line announces that we've been in a library the whole time and everyone laughs, like, those are fun, but those are lucky strike scenes. I would rather have had all that work done in the first 30 seconds of the scene, so then we can capitalize and play, continue to discover, continue to like see what else this scene is about. But I like definitive shape to my scenes, you know.
Okay, so we're gonna take a suggestion.
Cool.
Okay, so we'll break this down. Could we get a suggestion? Well, what kind of suggestion would you like to take? It doesn't even matter.
Let's get an emotion.
Fear.
Okay, so we got fear. All right. So then, when you hear that, what do you do with that?
Cool. Well, I would first think of how fear changes my posture, okay. Right? So, which I'm already doing it. It's making me cower. It's okay. Making me like hunch down.
Okay.
So I already feel like I am something okay. different. You okay. know? So it's, to me, it's like you take it and you put it through your body. Fear is fear is such a broad range and such a driving force for humans. That's also, I'm smiling at that suggestion because I'm like, I can do fucking anything now. It doesn't matter, right? Fear is epic. Fear goes everywhere. But I am in tune with how it changes my posture and how it changes my spine. I'm even like really feeling my shoulder blades and the blades of my back in a way that I haven't in a while.
So, you're really scrunched up there.
Yeah. Okay. So now I'm feeling this. So I would add an action to this. Let's say I'm like, we'll do something on the table, and I'm just like turning a little hourglass over and over.
It's freezing in here.
Yeah. Yeah. They do that on purpose. They do it to keep us agitated.
Well, it's working, Arthur.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna narc on you. Not this time.
Okay. Okay. We don't even need to even acknowledge that there's something to narc on. Cool? Let's keep it cool. Because I'd know nothing, you know nothing, we did nothing.
We did nothing. Nothing.
Okay. But you can't cry.
I'm not gonna cry. I'm not crying. Cry.
Don't be a pickle.
I don't even know what that means.
I know, man. It means I'm cool as a cucumber and you're sitting over there stinking like a pickle.
Don't put me down when we're in. This is high stakes. This is totally high stakes.
Tommy, look, buddy. Okay, Tommy. Look, buddy. You just gotta let me talk, okay? You just gotta get in there.
Well, last time I let you talk, you know what happened?
Yeah, you did a little time.
I did a little time. You were on the outside with Denise.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I kept your family fed.
You didn't even respond to the letters I sent you.
Well, I felt weird. I was living in your house.
Then when I came back, you were like, I didn't know you were going to be released this early. I still have another week here. Find another place to live.
Well, I was really insensitive, but I was having a bad week.
Well, fuck you.
Well, fuck you. You're right. Fuck me.
You didn't even pick me up from when they let me out of the joint. You didn't even pick me up.
Well, as I said, I thought you're coming back a week later.
If you would have read the letter, you would have known.
Well, I was prepared to come the week later. We were building a banner. You saw that. We had poster paper. We were making a banner. We were making a whole banner. It was going to be a week-long banner making to celebrate you coming home.
I didn't need a banner. I needed a friend.
Well, I did. I kept your family fed.
You don't even know what happens in prison, do you? Do you know what happened to me in prison? Do you?
Well, I'm going to guess... You got beat up a little?
Yeah, I got beat up. Every day I got beat up.
Probably had to eat some soap?
Yeah. I had to eat soap. They cut it up in little pieces.
You probably got fucked real hard against your
will. I did.
Yeah.
I did it for you.
Well, we'll make sure you won't go back this time, okay?
I have no confidence in you.
No.
You'll sell me out in a fucking New York second.
Look, I lived in your house for 2.5 years and I never fucked your wife, okay?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't get you something for that.
No, I'm just saying I did. I'm a better friend than what you're making me out to be. You know, we've had three heists in the last 7 months. We're really making some money and here we are just... And a little bit of a jam, and you're being
making
a pickle.
Money. It was like, okay, we went to the convenience store, and you're like, $40. We're in here for $40. We're making less money on each heist.
We were gonna take that 40 to the track. We're gonna flip that. We're gonna roll it over. We're gonna have a bigger payday.
Oh yeah.
We just needed some scratch. We needed something to start with. Well, you're being very pessimistic right now. You're looking very guilty. You want to go and get aggressively. Raped again for $40?
No, I don't. I don't.
Pull your shit together, then.
Pulling it together.
Oh, maybe I can get us some coffee. It's freezing in here.
Fuck, it's cold.
Thanks. Thanks for taking that time for me.
Now you say it.
Well, I
What is it? You're trying to set me up so I do it again? Is that it? Is it trying to butter me up?
No. If anything, it's my turn. It's my turn. I'll do it.
No, I'll do it. I'll do it.
Good, because I'm supposed to be coaching the boys in Little League this spring, and I didn't want it to be awkward. And it's $40. You'll be gone for a month.
I'll do it, because I've always looked up to you.
You've been a really loyal friend. Family.
I'm like family to you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I didn't have any family.
I know. But you like family.
Like a brother?
Yeah, like a brother, you know, like...
Older or younger?
Younger. Like, you know, I'm like 15, 16 years older than you. So I've like moved on with my life, and but I see you over the holidays, you know, and parents are always talking about you. So, you know, in our fantasy brotherhood, you've got parents that really care about you. They tell me about you all the time.
What about you? Why does it take you so long to answer?
Of course I love you. I just, you know, don't want you to think I mean it in some... non-brotherhood way.
I don't.
Okay. Okay. I love you.
I love you too. Can I hug you? In a non-brotherly way?
Yeah, of course. Just like...
Why are you getting so tense?
No, it's fine. I just... I'm not much of a hugger, but I understand this is a hugging moment.
This is our last time together for another month.
Good. You go in there and you get him, okay?
I will. I'll tell him I did it. It was all my idea.
Good.
Give me the gun.
Here.
All right. You're laughing. What's so funny?
I love it. You're going to go in there and... Are you going to fire that gun off, do you think? Are you going to go in there?
I was going to take the gun so that I took it from you so you weren't going to get busted.
Great.
And I was going to be like, okay, I'm the one who did
it. Great. Yeah. I love it. I also see you just walking in that next room just being like, pop, pop, pop. I'm his brother. We're family now.
How did we embody the lesson at the top with that?
Yeah. Well, we had a really, like, it put our eye line together, mm-hmm. right? I was hunched and kind of playing with this. And then I could see you mirroring that a little bit, right?
Yes.
You raised a shoulder, and then that became sadness. So I could see immediately that we had embodied this tension in our spine and in our necks. But I was feeling a little more like focused, I guess, or confident, and you were sad. Mm-hmm. So that to me immediately is there. That's something interesting. Mm-hmm. So we're the same. We have the same physicality. We're both cold, but then we're different. We have these different emotional takes, and then where that, you know, there's always something that's really interesting there, and I think we found it, right? I mean, we had this really kind of it was a relationship that was status driven. All the way to the end, mm-hmm. right? To the point where Tommy just wanted to be loved, right? Mm-hmm. Just wanted love. So that's what you get when you lead with emotion. Then emotion can transform. Emotion is powerful and is enough to drive a scene. And that little bit of transformation of going from fear and sadness to like the confidence of love or joy, or even the misguided confidence of love or joy, I think that makes for interesting work.
You gave me a great gift, and you said, you know, don't cry, which, of course, to me is like...
God, please cry.
Please cry, and please cry. And I have a hard time crying, and I always feel self-conscious. But for whatever reason, I didn't feel as self-conscious. I'm like, and what that did for me was it just made this guy like, okay, I don't know where it's leading, but it's like... There's a reason that he's really crying, and and so then the whole I had done time and all that, we started to really explore that, which was kind of fun.
For sure. And like my character trying to dictate behavior like that, that's just a status thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's such, what a shitty thing to say to someone that you care about who's in a nervous situation. It's so like, I don't know, like macho mentality of like, don't cry, like don't cry right now. But really it stems from fear. Like he didn't want you to cry because he didn't want you to look guilty.
Right. Right?
Like, I didn't want you to look, I just didn't want you to look guilty. I wanted you to be cool. I don't know. I love that background. It just put me in a place of like thinking about Boardwalk Empire. So that's what I'm looking for too. I'm looking for really clear images in my head that are inspired by what's happening in the moment too.
So give me an example of an image that was in your head that inspired you in the moment.
So as we were, once we got into this talking about he had gone to jail, I instantly just decided that jail was like in the 20s and 30s, and that this whole scene was like, and I was about to try and I was trying to find a nuanced way with like stating the year without it being so heavy handed.
1948. Yeah, 1948.
Pat Roosevelt. Yeah, but just the way our dialects bounced back and forth one another, and just the tone, and then just the, you know, someone taking a fall for someone else, just reminded me of one of the characters from Boardwalk Empire. So that just puts me in all of the imagery of that show, which is the different costumes and the hats and the slicked hair and just kind of the fogginess of the lens, even of the way the show is captured. And that helped, like, once I was in that place, then plus we're sitting and improvising into microphones, helps even further to go into that like radio brain, right? Mm-hmm. We're just seeing, you're seeing so much of the scene just from mind's eye.
So really you were also influenced by our actual environment, which was microphones and sitting in a table, and we're fairly close to
definitely
each other.
Definitely, yeah.
All right, we're going to take some questions from the audience because we got to keep moving here.
Cool.
So if we could turn the lights up really quickly. We got a question right here from Tom.
Sure.
I gotta just repeat the question, and that is, how do you help students to break break that barrier of bad habits?
Cool. Well, it definitely depends on the class. So if I notice something at IO, I might let that bad habit exist for a little while, unless it's being disruptive to like the goals of the ensemble, right? Or being mean-spirited or working against it. And then I would probably address the issue when I had three or four examples of it, but privately, right? So maybe like at a break or on the side of just say like, hey, I've noticed this thing that you're doing. Here are the three times that I've noticed it where it didn't work well. Maybe you could, you know, look out for that behavior.
Why is it important privately for you?
Well, I think just at IO, there's so much focus on ensemble that, and I do give like direct notes to people. But I think if I notice it's something that like it's a behavior that needs to be changed,
give me an example of what that would be.
Like calling women bitch all the time.
Okay,
you know, and thinking it's funny, right? So that's something that, actually, that's probably something that at this point I would nip in the bud immediately or just comment on, like, hey, your character just said this to this to this character 15 times in the scene. You might want to find a new word. Maybe it's something a little less, like someone who has a bit of an inappropriate touch, right? Someone who's hugging a lot. So that might be something that's making people feel uncomfortable that the person might not notice. Then that would warrant like to take to just privately because people are sensitive. I don't know, like getting reprimanded for a behavior in front of your peers that you're also like trying to be vulnerable and grow as an artist, like, and just that weird quagmire of a classroom where people might take advantage of someone who got called out for a bad behavior now, right? So I don't need the world to know that I'm addressing it. But here in the conservatory, I might do so because I don't know. I think we expect a certain maturity from it's a professional level conservatory, so I think we expect a certain level of maturity, and I feel more protected talking to like a group about a certain, you know, just about any issue, because that's what they're paying their money for, and that's part of their journey to be together, is to have good experiences and bad experiences. So I would probably, you know, treat it differently depending on the building.
Great. Yeah. Another question right here.
I know you've done a lot of different aspects of performing outside of just improv and sketch through commercials and other realms. Do you have any advice of how to find success in multiple areas of performing through other forms of theater in addition to improv without cutting yourself short in one of those areas?
How do you find, besides improv, finding success in other areas?
For me, like the biggest thing for me, I think, is to adjust my skill set to the medium. So that took me away from a lot of jobs early on, where I always played too big in front of camera, or I would even play too small in front of like a short form comedy show, choose to be dramatic, you know. So like once I kind of figure out the space, figure out the venue, figure out the gig, and really try to adjust my skill set to meet that gig. And I had to like take an on camera class and things like that just to figure out how to not have Jim Carrey face all the time, you know, and just like maybe a little more subtle and a little not so fidgety. I've got some twitches, so I have to like breathe and think about like not doing this every once in a while, you know. But mostly I think what I've discovered lately is to just try to enjoy it, right? Not get stressed out. Like, embrace the fact that, oh, I'm doing two or three different styles of performing this week. Don't get overwhelmed by it. Like, kind of feel positive about it and make it, like, again, I'm goal-oriented, so, like, I want to have three successful days on the job this week rather than, like, oh, man, I got to do all this. That's the biggest thing I have to, like, adjust in my own personality management is to stay, like, I fucking love this stuff rather than, oh, God, what's next, you know? So
great. One more question right here.
What do you
Hi.
What is your advice for being able to retain whatever you just did in an improv scene? Because I know something I struggle with is, like, when I'm finished and I'm trying to remember what I did in a set, I have such a hard time really remembering.
Is the question, like, what you did or what you're learning from it?
What I did. Like, if I'm for sketch purposes, like, if I'm trying to go back to it.
And rewrite it.
Rewrite it so I can, you know, then build off it. Like, I have such a hard time, like, being like, what did I do? What is this moment?
So when you're improvising stuff for sketch, right, and you're re-improvising, how do you retain that?
Cool. So if you improvise when you're high and then you get high later, no, we're kidding. it's that old trick.
Right.
You get to high when you study and then you get high before the test.
Right.
It's reps. It's the brain is a muscle that's that level of short-term memory is a muscle that you can improve. Take advantage of the fact that we all have cameras in our pockets too, and record your shit, or just voice record it. But literally, get it. If you are interested in doing improv to sketch, then get three or four people together and do a scene, and then talk about what you liked about the scene, and then do it again, and do it again, and do it again, just so at least you're getting 30, 40 seconds of it that are the same. And don't even worry about, like, building it to make it better. Like, this is an exercise where you're just trying to retain the scene and do it exactly the same. And you know what? It's a really hard thing, right? It's a really hard thing to maintain that, you know, that 30 seconds. But if you do that, you know, five or six times as a warm-up before you guys move on to other things, then you're going to start strengthening that part of your short-term memory, really. The other thing to do is, like, start memorizing some text. Like, look at a poem and try and memorize it as fast as possible, like 7 lines of it. Those were little things that I would do when I was struggling with just, like, taking in corporate scripts, you know, like getting handed something at 11 o'clock that I had to go across town and perform it at 2. That's a scary gig. So, like, I spent some time, like, purposely trying to strengthen my short-term memory. Reps, you know. Reps.
We got to wrap this up. I could go all night with you, but there's actually other shows in the building tonight.
Okay.
I'm not the only one. So we asked this question to end all the podcasts. What one piece of advice would you give to somebody starting out in improv comedy today?
Great. that love the art of it. Respect the art of it. Everyone who got famous through it, like, and who's really thriving, they're people who loved it, love the art of it. You know, if you're thinking about what comes next, then go do what's next, right?
Ryan Archibald, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Ryan Archibald. I also want to thank the Second City Training Center and Jesse Swanson for hosting Improv Nerd in Judy's Beat Lounge. Like to also thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, Sam Bowers, who is the director of the live version of Improv Nerd. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops, classes, and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd newsletter, go to jimmycorain.com. Also, we are taking over social media, and we're doing this very smartly, aren't we? Don't you think? We're very secretly. You don't want to take something over secretly, because that would be a coup. You want to let people know about it. So go to Facebook and like Improv Nerd, our Facebook page, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us at Twitter, Improv_Nerd. And then check out, and you please go to it, subscribe to it, and it's the YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, and you get to see clips from our live show. I mentioned Feral Audio before. I'm going to mention it again. It's got the number one comedy podcast on there, My Favorite Murder, but it's got some other great podcasts as well, including this one, including Put Your Hands Together, including Todd Barry's got a podcast, Matt Dwyer's got a podcast, Harmontown. I can go on and on and on. Just go to feralaudio.com for more information. And, of course, I want to thank you for listening. And remember, walk. Don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you fuck